call to order. We will start this afternoon with Senate File 1197, Senator Pappas. Welcome to the committee. This is the doula registry and health insurance, MA coverage for childbirth doula services. Senator Pappas.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I wanted to just briefly explain the bill and then have you hear from my testifiers, who are really the experts here. Our whole goal here is to ensure that if a patient requests the presence of a doula, that would be honored in a hospital setting, to establish a doula registry, and to expand medical assistance coverage to doula services. Sections 1 and 2 of the bill ensure that an expectant mother who is a patient in a hospital has the right to have a doula of the patient's choosing present during any discussion of treatment. And maybe we need a definition of what a doula is. Susan, do you want to just do that?
Sure. My name is Susan Lane. Thank you for having us here. A doula is a person who is specially trained to provide labor support to women who are giving birth. And by our scope of practice, we meet with women prior to birth in their homes. We stay with them throughout their entire labor, one the same person, so there is complete continuity, or what we call seamless care. And then we meet with them afterwards to support breastfeeding in the home.
Sections 3 to 6 requires the Commissioner of Health to establish and maintain a registry of certified doulas who submit an application, maintain a current certification form, complete a criminal background check, and pay the required fees. And that would be valid for 3 years. And Section 7 requires medical assistance to cover doula services provided by a certified doula. And we think that, in particular, since a third of all the births in the state are MA births, that we have a great potential to not only provide good services and have better outcomes for babies and moms, but also to save the state quite a bit of money. Those brief comments, I wanted to turn it over to my lead doula here, Susan Lane, and also hear from a couple of the other testifiers.
Ms. Lane.
Thank you. You have a sheet that looks like this in a packet that's been handed to you. I just want to give you a brief explanation. This is a summary of two programs that are currently running with some medical assistance dollars. Medical assistance dollars are not paying for the doula care, but they're paying the doulas for the prenatal and postpartum care through our health department now. One of them is the Everyday Miracles program, and Debbie Prudhomme is here and can talk to you specifically about how that's funded. And then the other is the Family Center Community Doula program, which serves women in Ramsey County only. The middle column uses the current statistics in birth to indicate what would have happened to the 722 women in these two studies had they been following the pattern and using the rates that are typical here for these different procedures. And then on the left and the right, it shows you what the improved statistics were, in these two programs. And the amount of money is what has been saved. And I'd like to point out that from these 722 births, it's pretty safe to assume that $2.5 million was saved over what the expectations would be for all other women in the same category in our state. So these are real programs. They're really happening. They're ongoing now. And they are saving money. And I think we are those of us who work as private doulas hired by mothers are saving insurance companies a whole lot of money. And in the past and in the future, we have had a lot of clients testify to that effect. So that's kind of what this is. The N equals is the number of women, and then the percentages are above that. So you can compare a 37% epidural rate to an expected 80%, an 18 or 12% cesarean rate as compared to our state average, which is 24.5%. And really, it's over 30 and up to 34% in some counties. And the biggie, the very big cost saver, is on birth weights. Women, particularly low-income women who are getting doula care, are having much better birth weights for their babies, fewer babies with low birth weights. And we are not the only program finding this. There is a program now at the University of Pittsburgh funded by Medicaid. Federal Medicaid will pay for doula care that is showing a decrease from an average of 10 days in the NICU to 6 days for the women working with doulas. That's at a cost of $10,000 per day in the NICU. So there, this study is ongoing, and you have a letter. They don't have the summary data yet because the program's too new, but on the back of this sheet, on the back of this sheet that has the little pictures on it, you have a letter from the director of that program with their university insurance provider. So I guess I'll just stop for a minute and see if there are questions.
Senator Pappas.
Let's continue with our testifiers then.
Okay. Debbie, do you want to talk a little bit about the Everyday Miracles program and how you function and what maybe the payment model is?
Absolutely.
State your name.
My name is Debbie Prudholm. I am one of the co-founders of Everyday Miracles, which was incorporated about 4 years ago, it'll be 4 years in June. We only serve women who qualify for medical assistance. There's no charge to the women we serve. We've had rapid rates of growth over the past few years, going from 74 births to 254 in a year.
Where are you located?
We're located in Anoka, but we are not county or hospital specific. So we will work in any of the counties in the area. Our funding comes from grants that are, as we all know, very hard to come by. And we receive reimbursement from UCare of Minnesota and MHP. Metropolitan Health Plan reimburses the doulas for prenatal education and postpartum care because they know that having their members receive doula services will, in the long run, save them money.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there an addition?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name's Judith Nylander. I'm a private practice doula and a childbirth educator. And one of the side benefits of our legislation would be that low-income women in underserved populations could become doulas. Right now we have a lot of doulas in the metro area and about 200 across the state of Minnesota. And most of us are like me, white women. And we get hired by middle and upper middle class white families. We do have a program at Riverside Hospital of trained Somali doulas that are doing a terrific job in their community, but we certainly need more of them. And we have very few African-American doulas. We know that women have a more have an affinity for and a way of listening to people of their own ethnicity. So if we could say to underserved populations, you could become a doula and you could make a living at it, then we could train people from the African-American community to serve those ethnicities, and it would make a big difference to the low-income women who would have this as a job.
Does that conclude your question? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess just a couple of questions. In the bill on page 3 that talks about defining certified doula and lists some organizations, what's involved in certification? What kind of time commitment? What cost is involved? What are the things that people are trained to do? Just can you talk a little bit about what's involved in becoming certified? Are all these organizations doing exactly the same thing? Are they doing different things?
The organizations that are listed are the primary organizations. I'm the state representative for Doulas of North America, which has trained about 50,000 doulas over the last 10 years in North America and also in Canada. The training consists of approximately 20 to 30 hours of class time. And I would say it's probably comparable to a 3-credit course. You have to read books and write papers and all of that sort of thing. And then the more complicated and difficult part that generally takes a little bit more time is that you have to attend the births of 3 women providing doula services, and you have to have a positive recommendation from the physician or midwife, the nurse, and the parent in all 3 cases. And that has to be reviewed and checked by the organization. And all it's a fairly large packet of materials that has to be sent in. So it generally takes between 1 and 2 years for certification to actually happen for most women. It can be speeded up a little bit if somebody's really ambitious. And programs like the Woodwinds Hospital Doula Program is very, very helpful because Woodwinds provides volunteer doulas, and their nurse manager there is a doula trainer herself. She has trained all of her nurses in doula care, and she also provides opportunities for doulas in training to do those 3 births and to have clients on a volunteer basis there so she's a very big help in getting more doulas certified.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what is the, just roughly, the cost to go through this certification process if I would not assume someone was going to do that?
The doula pays anywhere from $275 to $450 for a certification, and then an additional $60 a year for membership in the certifying organization. And then we have to recertify every 2 years, and we're required to have a minimum of 15, and some organizations say 20, continuing education credits that are certified by nursing organizations.
And, Madam Chair.
Senator Hand.
I think one last question. In your testimony and in one of the write-ups here, I'm not sure if I understand the major intent of the. Is the major intent of this bill to provide a service, or is it to provide an opportunity for people to get jobs?
The major intent is for the service, but it's worth noting that it is a kind of work that could be done and that we could recruit in communities for that would put some women on the tax rolls. It's just something we noted as a side. And that we hope would be considered in the fiscal impacts. And right now, that's not the case, because none of us are making a living at this.
Yes. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, it tends to be more of kind of a part-time income, but we think that in some of the immigrant communities and communities of color, that it's going to be very important to have a woman of your own culture that can attend you in birth. And most of the time, these women can't take time away from their own families or their own jobs unless there's some compensation. So there are many women who do it for free. There are many women who charge, you know, a reasonable amount if the client can, the birthing family can pay it. But it's a very important service, and it has the potential to save the state and the insurance industry if the insurance industry would adopt it. But hospitals in particular, a great deal of money because of, in the studies that have happened, that have been taken place so far, both locally and nationally, we have seen a great deal of savings. That women who have doulas tend to have a lower C-section rate, and that's a huge cost. They tend to have babies that are a higher birth rate, and low birth rate babies are very low cost. They tend to breastfeed, which means healthier babies. They tend to use interventions less, which are very expensive, epidurals and Pitocin and all kinds of interventions that can often negatively impact your labor, and an attempt to help you can often prolong your labor or make it too quick. So by following a natural process but providing the support and the comfort that women really need. I mean, women in birth, often aren't looking for machines. They're looking for, support. And I think we've mechanized birth to the point where we're not providing the kind of supportive services that women need.
And Madam, just
Senator,
my granddaughter just turned 5 today.
Senator Hand.
I was just going to ask.
I was at her birth. I was her doula.
I was just going to ask Senator Pappas if it's possible for labor to go too quickly. And I just say that because our firstborn, my wife, was in labor for over 24 hours.
And that was
a long time ago. But
Senator Pappas.
24 hours. My first birth was 27 hours, so I can relate. But the opposite is compared to being run over by a truck. You know, if you have too fast a labor, where everything just happens so fast, it's hard for your body to respond.
Additional questions from members? Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I believe that this bill will have at least 2 fiscal notes on it, so it would have to be referred to the Finance Committee.
Senator Wehrigan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking over here. Didn't realize you had the gavel. Sorry. My daughter would concur with faster birth being okay. My grandson's 3 weeks old, and he took 33 hours to get here. But the question I have is more one of a nature that you have the birth that looks like it's going along just beautifully. You're in the home. Suddenly you have the placenta abruption. What happens? Because that's something that has to be dealt with very quickly, either with cesarean or forceps or vacuum. But the baby has to get out of there now, and you have to stop the bleeding. How does a doula deal with that?
Ms. Lang.
Well, it's not a midwife.
We work in hospitals almost exclusively. It's occasionally we get called to a home birth and work with a home birth midwife, but we work in hospitals. Our meetings with the women before birth are primarily for the purpose of education, almost exclusively that, and also to get to know them so that we have personal history that is not a part of what is covered in hospitals. So that it is the beginning of the bond that is developed that helps the hormones flow through the birth.
Okay, thank you.
Additional questions from the committee? Senate Counsel has indicated that there are some possible technical amendments that need to be addressed. So I'd ask Ms. Kavanaugh to walk us through those at this time.
The first engrossment.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, on page 4, line 2, that should be subdivision 2, not subdivision 3. And on page 4, line 25, section 62A.0412, subdivision 4, should be deleted and replaced by section 148B.01, subdivision 2.
Technical amendments. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendments are adopted. Thank you very much, Ms. Kavanaugh.
If not, I'll move it. If there are no more questions, I will move. I would like to move that Senate File 1197 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Torres raised motion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you very much, Senator
Pappas. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think right now we will move on to Senate File 900, Senator Berglund, Care Patient Access to Pharmaceuticals Act. Senator Berglund.
And members of the committee, I have an amendment. It's a delete everything amendment for the bill. A1 amendment.
Senator Berglund moves adoption of the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, this bill was brought to me by one of the members of the House who has constituents who are in nursing homes and have got drug coverage through their pension plans. But because they're in a nursing home, the drug coverage they have will not meet their needs, and so they therefore have been required to join the Medicare Part D program in addition to the drug coverage they already have through a pension. And the real issue here is that nursing homes cannot dispense prescriptions that are not blister packed. And these prescriptions that are covered by their pension plan are not blister packed. They're filled as a prescription would be for a person living at home. So this amendment establishes a process for repackaging and dispensing drugs in unit dose packaging to residents of long-term care facilities when the drugs are originally dispensed in bulk containers not
suitable for use in nursing home facilities. Section 1 requires out-of-state pharmacies seeking non-resident special pharmacy registration to certify that upon request, the pharmacy will dispense medications prescribed for long-term care facility residents in unit dose packaging, or will comply with the section with the provisions of Section 2. Then in Section, in Subdivision 3 of Section 2, the bill authorizes a pharmacist or pharmacy under contract with a long-term care facility to repackage a resident's prescription drugs into the unit dose system compatible with the system used by the facility, and then allows the facilities to administer the drugs that have been repackaged according to this law. The provision does not allow for reuse of the unit dose packaging if the pharmacy, prescription is not fully utilized. It requires pharmacies to maintain records for 2 years for each repackaged drug, and requires the original dispensing pharmacy upon request to deliver the medications for long-term care facility residents directly to the contract pharmacy or pharmacist, and to provide the name and strength of drug and other drug-related information. The bill holds establishes immunity from civil liability for contract pharmacy and pharmacists and long-term care facilities for harm caused by repackaging drugs due to acts of omission by other persons. It allows the pharmacist or pharmacy to charge a monthly fee if not more than 250% of the medical assistance dispensing fee for each repackaged drug, not to exceed $100 per month for an individual resident.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Prettner Solon.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I have a few questions. One is, what happens when, this is high, what happens when the drugs are returned to the pharmacist? Can they restock them and resell them?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Prettner Solon, I don't believe that this law is envisioning that happening. They would be disposed of as they would be if the person had a prescription at home and didn't use all of the prescription.
But if they're
Senator Prettner Solon,
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator Berglund, if they're unit dosed, why couldn't they be restocked?
Senator Berglund,
they're usually kept at the, I mean, in a locked.
Mr. Weiberg is going to be here to help me answer questions about this, since he worked on getting the language in order. But I think it's because of a concern about potential liability, since these pills, while they've been packaged this way, originally were not packaged this way. They came to the pharmacy as a bulk prescription, and then they've been repackaged so they can be dispensed in the nursing home. But because they were not unit dose packaged that way originally, I think there would be concern about then, you know, reusing them for another person.
Madam Chair,
Senator Prettner Solon.
Senator Berglund, will they be putting them in blister packs? Is that the intent, and they have the capability of doing that?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Prettner Solon, that is the whole purpose of this bill, so that these people can use their prescription drug benefit that they have in their pension plans rather than having to pay a lot of money to be in the Part D program. Other nursing home residents who don't have these kind of private policies do not have to pay and sign up to be in the Part D program. Well, I mean, they're in the Part D program, but they don't have to pay for their drugs because they do not have other prescription drug coverage. And nursing home residents are not charged as a part of the Part D program. But if you have private coverage like these people do, then A, you're in a situation where you can't use it, but B, because you have it, you have to pay to be in the Part D program on top of your nursing home bill.
Senator Prettner Solon.
Senator Berglund, can these people bring their own prescriptions into the nursing home?
No. Senator Berglund.
Senator Pittner, so no. And that's exactly why a bill is needed. They can't bring their own medicines into the nursing home, and the nursing home is not allowed to dispense medicines that are not in a unit dose packaging system.
Senator Pittner Solon.
And then the handling fee, Senator Berglund, $100 per month seems high to me, especially since I would assume that if they were there long-term, they wouldn't need the individual dispensing. I mean, they could be in a regular prescription bottle or a monthly supply. But so if they were there for 2 or 3 weeks, it seems like $100 is a lot for an individual to have to pay for that privilege.
Well, Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Pittner Solon, I think they would prefer that fee to the fee they're paying for the Medicare Part D today, which is like $6,000 a year.
Senator Pittner Solon.
Madam Chair, but it was this a negotiated deal?
Well, the original
it seems
Senator
high to
Berglund.
Me.
Madam Chair and Senator Pittner Solon, the original bill as introduced didn't work. And so the folks from the nursing home industry and the pharmaceutical industry understood the problem and came up with the language to make it work. And I guess the feeling is that this is going to cost something, and certainly the state isn't in a position to pay for this repackaging, so there would be a fee then charged to the individual resident. But it would still save them a lot of money over what they're paying today.
Thank you.
Additional questions from the committee? Okay. Senator Berglund.
Then, Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 900 as amended be recommended to pass.
Senate Counsel has advised that the next committee that would need to see this would be the Judiciary Committee.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
On Senator Berglund's enthusiastic motion.
I guess it's because of the limitation on liability section.
Okay. On Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The bill passes. Thank you very much, Senator
Thank
Berglund.
Thank you, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I am here today with Senate File 44, which has to do with the credential verification for foreign trained medical school graduates. I am pleased to bring this bill forward in that it is deemed to be non-controversial and has no fiscal note attached to it. And at this stage in the game, that's kind of an exciting.
It
that's
really
kind of
is.
Exciting. with me today, well, first of all, I think before we really begin, is I would like to offer an author's amendment, which has been distributed, and I believe that is the A07-0006 amendment. So I would ask that that be adopted to get this bill in the shape that we need.
Do we have the?
It's in the pack.
Do we have the amendment? Okay, thank you. All of those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam
Go ahead,
Chair.
Senator Lynch.
And with that, today I have two individuals with me to speak to the finer details of this particular bill. And I think we'll begin with Frank Yossi with the Mayo Clinic.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Frank Yossi, and I represent Mayo Clinic here today. Physicians, this is a little background, physicians who wish to practice medicine in Minnesota must apply to the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice and present their credentials. Historically, that board has verified their credentials. In 2004, the law was amended to require that international medical graduates' credentials be verified by the Federation Credentials Verification Service of the U.S. Federation of State Medical Boards. The idea was that one place would be able to do this efficiently across the country. This was a good idea and concept, but it has really been a disaster, primarily for Mayo and the University of Minnesota, who have most of the international medical graduates in Minnesota. Apparently, the National Service was overwhelmed with demand. In any event, the process has been fraught with extreme delays, mistakes, and inconsistent responses to questions and issues, and I might add also increased costs. In meeting with the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice about a year and a half ago, when told that we, being Mayo and the university, would be pursuing a change in state law to make the use of their service permissive rather than mandatory, the director of the National Service said he would do the same thing if he were in our situation, therefore admitting that they weren't able to meet the demand. This bill does exactly that. It changes the law requiring mandatory use of the federal service to making it permissive. As I said, Mayo and the University of Minnesota are uniquely affected by this law and would appreciate your support.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, and I have one additional testifier, and I'd like to turn it over to Marty McDonough with the University of Minnesota.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, my name is Marty McDonough, representing the University of Minnesota. We want to echo Mr. Yossi's comments on the gist of the initial legislation. What I wanted to talk to you about real briefly was the amendment that was adopted prior to Mr. Yossi's testimony. This is legislation that we'd advanced last year as well, and it ended up not being passed in the final days of session. But it deals with the process of licensing for our medical students. And what it would do was it would give a little more flexibility and lengthen the timelines in the sequence of passing the three exams that our medical students have to pass to be licensed in the state. So that's what that paragraph does.
Thank you. Are there any questions from committee members?
Madam Chair, I have the A1 amendment.
Do we have copies of it?
Excuse me. I also have a frog. I haven't seen the A1 amendment.
Okay. You could give it to the author.
Thanks.
Senator Worgen, could you please explain?
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Lynch, this is not meant to make your bill controversial. It just deals with a circumstance where if someone that is applying or taking the test, but they have a problem for medical reasons with meeting the timeline or the number of times the test can be taken, the board may grant an extension, but they do have to have proof of the illness during the time when they should have passed it. So it's not forcing the board to do anything. It's strictly saying that they may increase the time and must be a documented illness.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Worgen. In a brief consultation with Mr. Yossi and Mr. McDonough, I would view this as a friendly amendment.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's what I was hoping.
Thank you. All of those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? So the amendment is adopted. Senator Lynch, do you have a motion for us?
That, Madam Chair, I would request passage of Senate File 44 to go be sent to the floor.
Any questions on that motion? If not, as amended. If all of those in favor of the motion as amended, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Next we have Senator Fischbach. Senate File 445.
Senator Fischbach.
Senate File 445. Oh, you know, maybe we should do, I've got an author's amendment, which is the A1 amendment. Maybe we should do that first.
Please go ahead, Senator Fischbach, and introduce your amendment.
And Madam Chair, I do have one oral amendment that I need to make that it was overlooked in the when we put together the A1. On page 1, line 16, we need to say registered dental assistants, so we need to add the word registered there.
Okay.
So line 16 on page 1 would read hygienist, comma, registered dental assistants, et cetera, et cetera.
Let's adopt this amendment, then we'll adopt. Is this a delete all amendment?
No, it's not a delete all amendment, but it is an author's amendment.
Okay.
So if we can just combine that all into one motion, that would be fine.
Are there any questions about the amendment? If not, all of those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Senate File 445 basically moves the requirement for a X-ray operator to a national exam that would be recognized by the commissioner. And the A1 amendment added a grandfather clause. Cleaned up the exemptions area where we had some exemptions, added a little bit of language so that those were very clear, and added a continuing ed requirement, and cleaned up the variance program that's allowed in there. And I think that basically my testifiers here would probably be better able to give you the reasoning behind the bill and answer any questions. So I'll turn it over to them.
Thank you. And welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Linda Koster, and I'm currently the board chairman of the Minnesota Society of Radiologic Technologists. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony supporting the change in the minimum requirements for those who operate X-ray equipment for use on humans in the state of Minnesota. I would also like to thank Senator Fischbach and the co-authors of this bill for recognizing the need to change this law. I am a certified and registered radiologic technologist. In order to become certified, I attended a 2-year nationally accredited radiography program and successfully completed an exam. As I previously stated, I'm currently the board chairman of the Minnesota Society of Radiologic Technologists. The MSRT is a professional organization consisting of registered radiologic technologists and imaging professionals. Part of our mission is to promote quality patient care. Quality patient care in radiology is twofold, one being the technical quality of the images to ensure a rapid and accurate diagnosis, the other being containment of the cost of health care. In order to obtain high-quality images, it is important that there be an adequate understanding of the factors and steps needed to achieve the end result. If there is this understanding, the physician, chiropractor, or other professional making the diagnosis is given adequate information to make a proper diagnosis, and the time required for each exam and the cost for materials is acceptable. However, if there is not an adequate understanding of these things, the quality of the imaging suffers, and additional resources in time and materials are used. The entire premise of this proposed legislation is to address these issues, to increase productivity, and to decrease the cost incurred in medical practice. We are not addressing who orders or interprets X-ray exams, only those who are exposing the patient to radiation. We understand that there may be a perception that anyone who proposes legislation stands to personally gain from it. However, this does not apply in this situation. We recognize that the X-ray operator is a valuable part of the medical team, especially in situations where the need for imaging is sporadic and the types of exams being formed are of the routine type. With 3 times more X-ray machines than registered radiologic technologists in the state of Minnesota, we have ample opportunity for employment. Also, in states with long-standing limited operator requirements, it has been shown that these requirements do not translate into higher salary increases for registered technologists. Currently, in order to take X-rays in the state of Minnesota, an individual must pass a test that includes, by statute, the topics of basic radiation safety, proper use of the equipment, darkroom, film processing, and quality assurance procedures. However, this test does not include very critical aspects of obtaining a quality X-ray, such as anatomy and pathology, how to properly position the patient in order to X-ray the part of the body the ordering practitioner is interested in, or what exposure factors to use in order to obtain a diagnostic X-ray. This bill simply proposes that anyone who performs X-ray exams successfully complete a nationally recognized exam that covers all of the things needed to obtain a diagnostic X-ray, including anatomy, positioning, and technical factors. Currently, 27 states use a nationally recognized exam, some since 1985. Current X-ray operators do not have to requalify under this proposal. The impact on medical practice is nothing but positive. Again, better images result in quicker and more accurate diagnosis. The increased productivity and decreased material costs positively affect the bottom line. The initial cost is minimal. Currently, the cost of the X-ray operator exam is $45 to $55 versus $70 to $75 for a nationally recognized exam. We feel that changing the minimum requirements for those performing X-ray exams will increase the efficiency of medical practice and increase the quality of care that we provide for our patients. Now I'd like to turn it over to Jean Frank, who has a couple of examples of radiographs that we'd like to share with you, and then I would like to conclude once he's finished.
Thank you very much. My name is Eugene Frank. I am from Rochester, Minnesota. I, like Linda, am a registered radiologic technologist. I have been a radiologic technologist in Minnesota for 37 years. I worked at the Mayo Clinic for 31 years, and I'm a retiree from Mayo Clinic. My last 21 years there, I was director of the school, so I have taught radiologic technologists. But I also continue to teach radiologic technologists today at Riverland Community College in Austin. I'm here to share with you today several things that Linda started. But first, I want to talk about the education required to become a registered radiologic technologist and the education to be an X-ray operator. And then I'm going to pass around two radiograph examples to support why we are seeking a change in Minnesota to a nationally recognized examination. Well, radiologic technologists like us attend six semesters of college, which is 3 years of regular college work, including comprehensive direct patient care in hospitals and clinics. We write a national certification examination, and we are required to participate in continuing education just like any other allied health professional. We work in the medium to large hospitals and clinics throughout Minnesota where comprehensive radiology work is performed. Well, limited X-ray machine operators receive no education. They're hired by small hospitals and clinics throughout Minnesota because they're needed and they're trained on the job. In most instances, their work is indeed limited. However, they do use radiation on human beings, including children, and they perform a fairly wide range of general X-ray examinations, such as chest and extremity X-rays. Although they do write an exam now in Minnesota, it is not a recognized exam by any approving body. We even have no idea who does it, what's on it, and so on. And it only covers one of the five technical areas required to perform radiography. A nationally recognized exam, as Linda stated, would cover all of the categories needed to perform an X-ray exam to standard. The major issue that limited X-ray machine operators face is that, and we feel bad for them as registered technologists, they simply do not have enough technical background in order to do this type of work. And they don't know how to set the technical factors to obtain a proper X-ray at the correct density and contrast, and most importantly, within the proper dose range. And again, they just do not understand the concept of what is a diagnostic or a non-diagnostic image. Those of us who are registered try to help them as much as we can in these places, but there's only so much that we can do. But I want to share with you two examples of what comes to us or what comes to our radiologists on a regular basis from these places, and to give you an idea of why we want the national exam. I'm going to pass around, and I checked in here. The light is bright enough. If you put these radiographs up to the light, you can see what is the issue here. First of all, I'm going to pass around a chest X-ray that we've all had and you're familiar with. This chest X-ray, the dark one, you'll see it is very dark. It's literally black. It was performed by a limited operator. The image is overexposed and very dark. Now, this X-ray actually contains a fairly good-sized cancer, but it was missed because of the overexposure. Even the physician could not see the tumor. Technically, the limited operator did not make a mistake here. She simply did not know how to correct the exposure and clearly did not know how to get the image to the correct density. Now, this is an example of a patient that was sent home. 10 months later, went to a very large hospital, and a chest X-ray was ordered. And you'll see the second image right here because it's very clear. You may probably go ahead and pass the two around. One. On the second image, that's the appropriate density and contrast. The image was done by a registered radiologic technologist in a large hospital and has the appropriate density and contrast. But most importantly, there's a cancerous tumor on here. And if you go back as much as you can and look at the original X-ray, that tumor was present. Now, this patient unfortunately died. The tumor was missed on the initial radiograph because it was too dark. The family sued, and a multimillion-dollar settlement was approved out of court. Now, that's probably a more extreme situation, but I want to point out just one more common everyday thing probably that happens, because whether they're taking an X-ray in a little hospital or clinic or in the large facilities where we work, you're taking an X-ray that has to be the proper density and contrast and dose in order to make a diagnosis. This is an example of a shoulder. And another common thing that happens with limited operators not knowing how to set the techniques is this is a very light, underexposed shoulder. And you can see that. And again, this is underexposed. It's too light. And this second image was repeated and is the correct density and contrast. But the point here is that the image had to be repeated and a dose given to the patient, and it cites two common problems that limited operators unfortunately face. As you look at those, you'll see that, again, on those first ones, one is very dark and the other is the appropriate density and contrast, and the second is light and had to be made darker. But Linda is going to comment further on a couple of issues related to this, and then I'd be happy also to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you very much for your attention. Linda?
Thank you for your testimony.
Linda.
I don't really have any further comments unless there's any questions from the committee.
Are there any questions from committee members? I have a question. Senator Fischbach, I don't know if you or your testifiers will be able to respond. I have in language in line 119, page 1, it says the individual has passed a national examination determined to the satisfaction of the Commissioner of Health. Could you explain, so if they pass the examination, I assume it comes with results, and is the commissioner responsible for interpreting the results, or why do we need this language in here that says to the satisfaction of the commissioner?
Madam Chairman and the members of the committee, the exam that's most commonly used, the nationally recognized exam that's most commonly used, is done in a contract basis with the states themselves. The organization that provides this exam contracts with the states directly because each state has different requirements for their licensing or their certification or their requirements for anyone who takes x-rays in each specific state. So the nationally recognized provider provides the exam to the state. The state determines the passing rate, issues whatever, a license, whatever piece of paper that the state issues in order to let the individual know that they've complied with this. And it's a contractual basis, from what I understand, between the state and the provider.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Fischbach, I have two questions. The first one, is this bill supported by the Department of Health?
Senator Berglund, the department has not contacted me at all. I don't know if Linda has had contact with.
Senator Berglund and members of the committee, I have let the department know as much as I can about the process and those kinds of things. They have not been involved in giving us any information as far as what we should put in the bill, what we should not put in the bill. They've remained neutral on it, but they do know that it's here.
Okay, and then the second
Senator
question,
Bergen.
Madam Chair, that I have is, will this change the special revenue fund for this in this area, this addition, this $20 for these limited x-ray operators that currently is not being paid? Will that need to be appropriated?
Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, that is a good question. I guess it would probably show an increase depending on the numbers, although it is grandfathered in, so you won't see, you know, not everybody has to, or the folks are grandfathered in, so you're not going to see a huge number of people this, you know, in the next few years. You're going to see the newer x-ray operators paying that increase.
Well, the first two-year period ends January 1st, 2010. So it would be on our tracking, wouldn't it, then?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I think it would be minimal, though. I think the numbers, the dollars would be minimal.
Right. Madam Chair,
Senator Berglund.
Senator Fischbach, the only thing is that when you pass bills like this, that allows them to collect the money, but it doesn't allow them to spend it. And usually the reason you have them collecting the money is because there would be an expense in terms of, you know, making sure the continuing education requirements are being followed.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, this particular language was added by the House Subcommittee, the House Health Subcommittee. It's the continuing the portion that you're talking about is the continuing education portion, where the commissioner does approve the continuing education and all x-ray operators do have to comply with the continuing education, whether they're grandfathered in initially or not. This was added by the House Subcommittee. As far as the tracking, I'm not familiar with how all of that works, but that's where it came from.
Well, Senator Bergen.
Madam Chair, Senator Fischbach knows that we usually have a better reason for doing things than the fact that the House did it.
May I respond? Madam Chair,
Ms.
Senator
Kester.
Berglund, there is an excellent reason for asking for continuing education for current x-ray operators. Current x-ray operators have passed the x-ray operator exam that does not include all of the aspects of obtaining a quality radiograph. The reason for the continuing education is so that they can mainly come up to speed with what the new x-ray operators are going to be able to demonstrate by passing this nationally recognized exam, in that they will be getting continuing education on all of the aspects, including positioning, exposure factors, and those kinds of things. So there is an excellent reason why the continuing education is put in there.
Madam Chair,
Senator Bergen.
And Senator Fischbach, I think probably the bill should go to the Finance Committee. I thought we were done today, but I guess as long as this committee keeps meeting, we'll never be done.
I just think we need to get a fiscal note so we can see.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is on the exemptions. I want to be real clear about who's exempted and if what they're currently teaching in the schools is going to be enough to cover the dental hygienists, dental assistants, and the others that are outside of this. Are they going to remain outside of the scope of this?
Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, as far as the exemptions go, we know that in the dental practice, the dental assistants, the registered dental assistants, and the dental hygienists are covered under the Dental Practice Act. So we understand that is covered under their act. As far as the certified nurse anesthetist, that exemption once again was added during the House process. We have concerns about the educational process within these programs. We don't know that there's X-ray training within these programs. Within about the last 5 minutes, I have been made aware that in pain management programs, there is some X-ray training, which is something new, something that I did not know up until about 5 minutes ago.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Currently, the dental assistants and hygienists do have many many hours of credits that they have to take their in dental practice X-rays, and I just want to make sure that this isn't going to change that part of their education.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, no, that's Senator not, and that's by. Actually why we added registered dental assistants. I was not aware that there was difference between them, but yeah, so it won't change it. And as a matter of fact, Madam Chair, unless there's other questions from the committee, I do have an oral amendment I'd like to make to kind of clean that up, since we've been having discussions regarding those exemptions as we took testimony. Oh, I guess.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just maybe before we do that, just one other question for Mr. Frank. In your testimony, you sent around the pictures, and I'm a little bit troubled, I guess. The argument is that the one X-ray was done by someone with a limited license or a limited certification, or I've forgotten what exactly the term, and the other was done by someone who had the full training and the full license. But it would seem to me that if I'm a physician and I order an X-ray and I get one that I can't see anything, I would order another one. And it's troubling to me that what you're saying is that the first X-ray was taken and the physician looked at that and decided that was an acceptable X-ray. Is that what you're saying happened? If I were a doctor, I wouldn't accept that. I'd say, I need to know what this X-ray is seeing, and this is completely dark. It's obviously not exposed correctly. Why would I accept that? And I guess the question I'm getting to is, what you were describing was something that you're suggesting is fairly common, that poor X-rays are done and then are used or misused to form diagnoses. But to me, the critical step would be that the physician would say, I can't make a diagnosis based on this poor image. And so why wouldn't they just say, redo it?
Mr. Frank.
Thank you. I apologize. I can't see your name, Senator, so please indulge me.
And
Madam Chairman, I'd be happy to answer that. We're as certified radiologic technologists, we do our work on our side of the department and so on. In most of these small hospitals and clinics, there are no radiologists, and I'm here to say that a lot of those X-rays go through and are read exactly as you see them, Senator. That is relatively common. When there's a radiologist present in-house in the larger hospitals and clinics, they typically will reorder those. So that does occur. And many times in those environments that we're faced with all the time as we try to help those limited operators, the doctors actually get used to they see a lot of that level of quality, and because they do not want the patients to receive so much radiation, what happens a lot, I'll be honest with you, is they do not know how to correct. They basically have one technique for one body part and can't adapt and adjust, and so they do accept that image. But I will admit, in many cases, as they learn and they get more comfortable, or as they come to some of the courses that we try to help them, when we teach them, the limited operators, they will learn to adjust those techniques. But the point is that a second and sometimes a third and even a fourth x-ray is taken to get it to the correct density. So not every x-ray is sent through as you saw it there.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any more questions? Senator Fischbach had an amendment that she would like to do, but if you have any questions. Senator Worgen.
I do. I've been trying to kind of think how to phrase it. In the case of some very rural clinics, Senator Coring, Senator Laurie, myself, we have some very rural clinics. Isn't a limited x-ray tech better than no x-ray tech if we have these standards in place and don't have the people that have taken the test ready to run the equipment?
Ms. Kasser or Mr. Frank?
Madam Chair, Senator Worgen, we understand and agree with the concern of access to care. We know that the limited x-ray operators are out there, and the exam that they have now is better than nothing. We acknowledge that. However, we also acknowledge that it could be even better. That's why we're asking for the nationally recognized exam that covers all of the aspects of taking an x-ray. What happens with these x-ray operators, and we deal with them all the time, they come to us all the time asking for help because they don't know. They don't know how to do this. They've not been shown properly. And they do give the services, but we can help them give better services. And that's the point of all of this. Does that address your...
Madam Chair...
Senator Worgen?
It partially addresses it, but again, it's more in the rural areas, so most members at the table probably can't even relate to what I'm saying, but I'm sure Senator Laurie can, that, you know, as you said, they do pass an exam. It's better than no exam. And the physician looks at the x-ray. I'm really shocked to hear what you're saying about the physicians, that they don't have a higher demand for the quality of x-ray that they're getting from a patient. That's actually a whole lot more concerning to me than the fact that the x-ray isn't good in the beginning. But I still have the concern for the rural clinic and the possibility of not being able to get someone that has the national certification, and then you have no one.
Ms. Kasser.
Madam Chair, and Senator Worgland, we are not asking that those who are currently practicing go back and retake the exam. The ones that are currently practicing will continue to practice. So as far as the continuum of care, it will be there.
Senator Worgland.
Well, Madam Chair, not necessarily. I don't know. Maybe it's my lack of knowledge. I don't know how long it would take to get the national certification. I don't know necessarily how expensive it is to get the national certification. I don't know enough details, but I still see the potential for a problem in the very rural clinics.
Mr. Frank.
Thank you. If I may, Senator Reagan, Madam Chairman, if I may add to that, we partially discussed this. Right now, as we have said, there is an exam for the limited operators. We work very closely with all of these limited operators. Every large hospital in Minnesota has 10 little ones they're connected to in some way, and that's what draws them to us for these problems and questions. Now, We have never been made aware that there's been a problem anywhere in Minnesota that they could not get limited operators. Typically, they make arrangements in the way that they do, or they say, okay, you're leaving, we're going to start training that person. The exam is readily available on computer 7 days a week type of thing. And I think that I appreciate the question that you raise, Senator, but I'm thinking that nothing is really changing other than we're going from this exam that tests in one area to this exam that tests in the five areas. It's just as readily available, and I'm not sure that it would prevent a hospital or clinic from hiring a limited operator, because there doesn't seem to be a problem right now that we're aware of. And that's because they typically train their people who are already working there. They don't go out and seek. You don't see ads for limited operators. They take anybody within the hospital who's worked there and actually train them. That's what we see out there. Somebody who's familiar with the hospital and the doctors, and they can be anybody from secretaries and file people to.
I am curious about the problems that we currently have and the reasons we are pursuing this. If we have a system in place that is working, why do we have to have this process to get the national certification in place in Minnesota?
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, it's because it's incomplete. The test now does not test on all of the aspects that the operator needs to know in order to obtain a good quality radiograph. The operator isn't asked how to position the patient. The operator isn't asked how to properly expose the patient to get the good quality films that they need in order to make the diagnosis. The operator isn't asked anything about anatomy or pathology or those kinds of things. This nationally recognized exam will cover all of those things. And one other thing about the nationally recognized exam, some of the states that are using this nationally recognized exam are Montana, Wyoming, Nebraska, Iowa, and some very rural states as well. And they seem to be able to continue the access to care by using this examination. And they have their diagnosis is quicker and their costs are going down because of that. But that's why the nationally recognized exam is because it's complete.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from committee members? Senator Fischbach, did you have an amendment that you would like to introduce?
Yes. Madam Chair, I guess it's probably easiest off the A1. So on the A1 amendment, on line 1.16, we would, after registered nurse anesthetist, that's my word I can't pronounce, we all have one of those, so we would delete who have complied, and then on line 17, with the rules established by the commissioner regarding fluoroscopy training. So we're deleting that whole phrase, who have complied with the rules up until the training. And then I would like to add in its place, it would be comma, physician's assistants and. So it would read nurse anesthetist, comma, physician's assistants, and then the and is existing.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Senator Fischbach, you're taking out the words who have implied altogether?
Yes. And Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, that next line. And Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, that's because there is training for nurse anesthetists that they would receive training during pain management. What we found out in the last few minutes that they would be trained in that, so there's no reason to require them to comply with rules because they do receive that training in school.
So, Madam Chair and Senator Fischbach, it says this section does not apply to these folks
yes. with the rules established by the commissioner.
No, that goes to.
Or that goes to?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, on line 16, page 1, line 16 of the A1 amendment, we're taking out who have complied, and then down to line 17, with the rules established by the commissioner regarding fluoroscopy training.
That's all gone.
Yes. And it's replaced with anesthetist, comma, physician's assistants. Because the, and Madam Chair, because the physician's assistants, we believe that they were accepted in their, or they were exempted in their act last year, but we just want to make sure by adding them here so that everything's consistent. That's why we're adding PAs in here.
Are there any questions about the amendment? Do members wish to review the amendment? Do we need counsel? Is that okay? Okay. So all of those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Well, then, Madam Chair, if you will entertain a motion, I'll make the motion to move it on to the Health Budget Committee, since Senator Berglund's requested it.
Okay. Any questions? If not, all of those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, Senate File 2056, and I'd like to offer the A5 amendment as an author's amendment.
Okay, she's passing it around.
Is this a deleted amendment? Does this look like it's an addition?
And Madam Chair, while it's being handed out, I'll describe the issue and the bill. First of all, the bill, the amendment would require the Commissioner of Health consulting with the PCA to set drinking water standards for atrazine, which is a commonly used corn herbicide in Minnesota. Right now, the standard for public water supplies, which is set by the federal government, is at 3 parts per billion. The Minnesota standard, which supplies for private wells, is 20 parts per billion. Section, paragraph A of the bill in the amendment would be requiring the health department to set the standard at 3 parts per billion across the board, so it's the same for private wells as is for public water system. And then the paragraph B would require by December 31st of 2007 that the Department of Health would set drinking water standards for health risk limit for atrazine in private wells and public water systems. And if they set it at a level over 1 part per billion, they could set whatever level they chose, other than it would have to be below the 3 parts per billion. They could set it at any level, at that level or below, but if it's greater than 1 part per billion, they should provide evidence that's meeting the legal requirements in Chapter 144, which require that the commissioner ensure that these adequately protect the health of developing fetus, infant, and child, which are, I mean, we have health-based standards. They're supposed to accommodate not just the average citizen, but vulnerable populations, again, developing fetus, the pregnant woman, and the young child. Have a particular sensitivity to pesticides, particular concern for safety. So we would be requiring the department, if they set it over 1 part per billion, that they would have to at least spell out in writing why they feel that standard is sufficient to protect the public. Atrazine, as I said, is a commonly used corn herbicide in Minnesota. It's produced by a Swiss manufacturer, Syngenta, but they don't sell it in Switzerland because it's not allowed to be sold anywhere in the European Union at all, because it's a fairly long-lasting pesticide, and the European Union has banned it totally. As I said, the federal law is at 3 parts per billion. We had last year, 2 years ago, we had in the Environment Committee, we had testimony from a California biologist who's done a lot of research on this, who found that 1/10 of a part per billion, 1/10 of this 1 part per billion level, that it had an impact on hormone. It was a hormone disruptor, and had impact on feminizing male frogs and other. It's been found to have impacts on not just reptiles and amphibians, but also on mammals, including people. The 1/10 of a part per billion, again, has a. He found. Dr. Hayes found it has an impact even at 1/10 of the level we are suggesting they might want to set it at. Again, they can go higher than that, but they'd have to show that they believe it does protect the public health at that level. For comparison, California's maximum contaminant level is 1 part per billion. California's public health goal is 0.15 parts per billion, or about a sixth as much as that. But again, as I said, this is manufactured by a Swiss company. They can't sell it there because it's been banned in the European Union. Several counties in Wisconsin, I believe, have banned it. But I'll move the A5 amendment as an author's amendment, and then I have several witnesses who would like to speak to the bill. So I'll move the A5 amendment.
Any questions about the amendment? Senator Haynes?
Senator Marty, I think line 1.5 isn't written correctly. I think that atrazine needs to be deleted where it is there on the third word. And after health risk limit, I think you need to put in of atrazine. I think it's just...
For atrazine?
Of.
Okay.
For of. It's of.
I will incorporate that into the amendment. So on line 5, we delete atrazine, and after health risk limit, we would insert of atrazine.
Okay. With the amendment to the amendment, all of those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the amendment is adopted.
And with that, I have several witnesses.
Madam Chair.
Good afternoon, Senators. And welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Julia Earle. I'm the Program Director of Preventing Harm Minnesota, a children's environmental health organization. I'm here today to advocate for children's health and well-being as it relates to toxicants in the environment and atrazine in particular. I support the proposed atrazine legislation based not only on the scientific studies conducted by Dr. Hayes and others, but also for moral reasons as a children's environmental health advocate, parent, and consumer of drinking water in Minnesota. I have a Master of Science degree from the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and Environment. I'm proud to be a Minnesotan and enjoy living in a state noted for its many lakes, loons, prairies, and farms. Unfortunately, our beautiful state isn't as pristine or healthy as we'd like it to be. It's a place where frogs have birth defects, where lakes have fish consumption advisories, and where exposure to atrazine may cause cancer, reproductive health disorders, and neurological impairments. I'm here today to urge you to support the proposed legislation by Senator Marty. While I'm not aware of specific studies regarding the impact of atrazine on children, we do know that children are more vulnerable to exposure to toxic chemicals. We also know that childhood rates of reproductive health disorders, such as hypospadias, when the urethra on a newborn baby boy is in the wrong place, and decreased male sperm counts are increasing dramatically and are believed to be due to the impact of endocrine disrupting chemicals in the environment. Atrazine is an endocrine disruptor. That is, it mimics natural hormones in human bodies and gives the wrong signal to our reproductive systems, such as where the urethra belongs on a developing fetus and a pregnant woman. In addition, studies find that, quote, all pregnant women have at least one kind of pesticide in their placenta, unquote. So we may connect the dots. First, children are the most vulnerable to negative impacts from toxic chemicals. Second, endocrine-disrupting chemicals cause reproductive health disorders in humans. Third, atrazine is an endocrine-disrupting chemical. Fourth, pesticides are found in human placentas. Therefore, I believe it's safe to deduce that atrazine levels in Minnesota's drinking water should be reduced, ideally even as low as 0.1 parts per billion, if not completely eliminated. Next, I'd like to briefly discuss children's environmental health to help understand why this poses a particular problem for babies and youth. Scientists, healthcare providers, legislators, parents, and environmental health activists are increasingly aware of toxic body burden studies that indicate the pervasive and insidious nature of the spread of toxicants through the environment into our bodies. While we may be aware of the myriad of toxicants in the bodies of adults, tragically, many standards fail to recognize not only their presence in children, but also their deleterious impact. Rates of childhood illness and disease, termed the new pediatric morbidity, are increasing at alarming rates in the United States. Examples include asthma, childhood cancer, learning and behavioral disabilities, and reproductive health disorders such as the hypospadias I mentioned. What are the causes of children's environmental health problems? The causes for these devastating diseases and developmental disabilities are not completely understood. Some experts estimate 10 to 20% of these illnesses are of genetic origin, while others are the consequence of trauma, infections, or obstetrical difficulties. For the remaining roughly 80%, it has become increasingly recognized that, quote, children's exposure to toxic chemicals in the environment cause or contribute to the causation of these diseases, unquote. For example, the National Academy of Sciences estimates that as much as 28% of neurobehavioral disorders in children are from toxic exposures in the environment. We also know that in utero exposures to PCBs and methylmercury can cause a loss of intelligence. Children are routinely exposed to a myriad of synthetic chemicals in the environments where they live, learn, and play, such as homes, childcare centers, schools, parks, and public places. Tragically, very few of the 80,000-plus synthetic chemicals used in the United States have been tested for human health safety, with an even smaller number tested for their potential toxicity to children, infants, and fetuses. Why are children more vulnerable? Children are more vulnerable to toxic chemicals than adults. Pound for pound, they breathe more air, drink more water, and eat more food than adults. For example, a resting infant's air intake is twice that of an adult. Children in the first 6 months of life drink seven times as much water as the average adult in the U.S. To demonstrate the fact that children eat more food than adults on a pound for pound basis, I often make reference to my daughter Sophie when she was 18 years old. At a given lunch, she had her applesauce, carrots, and water, and ate two hot dogs. Two hot dogs look like a lot of food for an 18-month-old toddler. When you convert that for an adult, that's roughly one hot dog for every 10 pounds. Or for someone like me, that's 13 hot dogs in one meal in one day. So imagine if that hot dog was tainted with dangerous chemicals. The point is that children have heavier exposures than adults from toxicants in air, water, and food. Children also have higher exposures from their hand-to-mouth contact and their play near or on the ground. Babies, children, and adolescents are also more vulnerable than adults to toxicants given their very unique and rapid stages of growth and development. Consider the new baby in your family that seemingly turned into a toddler overnight, or the teenager down the street that shot up like a weed. They look like they are growing very rapidly, and in fact, they are. In addition, however, their bodies are going through very unique stages of development as their brains and organs develop and grow. These systems are very delicate and are uniquely vulnerable to perturbations caused by environmental toxicants, which may have lifelong deleterious impacts. Diseases caused by exposure to environmental toxicants during the early years of childhood or even in utero may not appear for years or even decades. In conclusion, we have an amazing opportunity in Minnesota to promote public health and children's environmental health in particular. Please help protect children from the dangerous effects of atrazine by supporting Senator Marty's proposed legislation. Where there's any question of uncertainty, we must err on the side of caution and protection of all our children's well-being. As Marion Wright Edelman has stated, the future, which we hold in the trust for our own children, will be directly shaped by our fairness to other people's children. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Senator Marty, I just have been made aware that we need to move quickly.
Yes.
We have
We're going to move as quickly as we can. Next, have Paul Sobosinski, who's a farmer. I'll ask all witnesses to be as brief as possible.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'm here to testify today on behalf of the Land Stewardship Project. The Land Stewardship Project is a farm and rural organization that works to promote sustainable agriculture. By that, we mean supporting the community, the farmer, and the environment. Besides working for the Land Stewardship Project, I also farm in southwestern Minnesota. I use chemicals on my farm. I have used atrazine. After hearing Dr. Tyrone Hayes' testimony in the House a couple weeks back, it certainly has caused me to take another look, and also our organization, to look at this issue. We think that this bill moves in the right direction, and we think it should move forward. Farmers and farm families are in the front lines in terms of exposure, in terms of chemical use. One of the pieces that really strikes at me as a farmer that would be helpful for farmers is that we do more work around the area of health risk assessment as it relates to all farm chemicals, because farmers do want to do the right thing. And I think this bill is a step in the right direction and ought to move forward. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Judy Helgen. I'm a retired research scientist from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, where I worked on biological monitoring of frogs and wetlands and became involved with the deformed frogs. And during that time, we were very concerned that pesticides might be implicated in causing the deformities of the frogs. There were Canadian researchers who were quite adamant that pesticides were causing deformities in Ontario, Canada at the time. This was in the mid-1990s when the deformed frogs then erupted in Minnesota and many states and countries. We were concerned about pesticides. I was learning from Perry Jones here from the USGS that pesticides were coming down in the rainfall in Minnesota, some at rather high concentrations, which alarmed me because the frogs reproduce in the wetlands in the spring, and the spring was the time when there was the most. I was trying to find information about pesticide use around the deformed frog sites and discovered that I couldn't because it's proprietary information. I then have learned now that the Minnesota Department of Agriculture does monitor pesticides, but a very, very few. They only right now are monitoring 8 of the top 20 sellers of 200 that are used. Dr. Tyrone Hayes, I've heard in scientific meetings since 1997, his work has repeatedly shown that the atrazine causes ovaries to grow within the testis of male frogs. And what it's doing is it's converting the male sex hormone testosterone to estrogen. And that can feminize males and lead to other health effects that I think Dr. Gary will be referring to. We were concerned with the deformed frogs about chronic low exposure, and I think that that's the effects of something that's low in the environment. I think that's what this committee is concerned with in trying to lower the level of atrazine that people would be exposed to. Our biology is really not all that different from frogs. You would say that there are some differences, but as Dr. Hayes has pointed out, the thyroid hormone, estrogen, and testosterone are the same hormones in frogs as they are in humans. And so we should be worried about exposure not just to the wildlife but to the humans. I just want to point out, too, that atrazine is one of the pesticides that has breakdown products that hang around in the environment. And a worry that I have as a biologist is that these chemicals hang around, and we don't know anything about how long they stay in the environment, and we don't know how toxic they are because EPA does not require that they're tested. So I've seen some of the agriculture department's monitoring data for atrazine, and when they summarize the three or four breakdown products with atrazine, it's a good idea because the atrazine itself may be gone, but its progeny are still there. And lastly, one problem we have in general in interpreting pesticide concentrations in the environment is the agency that I worked for has very few standards for water quality for pesticides. They only began in the 90s. They now have three standards, one of which is atrazine, for currently used pesticides. Most of the standards they do have are for the long since banned chemicals like DDT. So I believe the standard that PCA has for water quality, I know we're talking about wells here, is too high. It's much higher than the level that Dr. Hayes found, which was the 0.1 part per billion to have these terrible effects on the sexual organs in the frogs. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Perry Jones. I'm a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, and I have worked with Dr. Judy Helgen previously with the malformed frogs issue, and we dealt with actually looking at pesticide concentrations at those sites, and I continue to work with a program through the Department of Interior called the Amphibians Research and Monitoring Initiative, which we continue to look at pesticides in Iowa and Illinois and their effect on amphibians. And I'm here to provide some background as to where we're seeing atrazine in the environment in itself. And it's found throughout the environment. We find it in the rainwater, surface water, and groundwater. However, the concentrations in groundwaters tend to be much lower than what we see in surface waters. But in surface waters and streams, they have recorded values above 3 parts per billion for isolated periods of time. We do find pesticides throughout the state. Even Dr. Michael Thurman found pesticides in Isle Royale where there's very little use at all of the pesticide. So it's pretty ubiquitous throughout the state. One thing we've found in particular is that even though atrazine is often found at fairly low concentrations, its effects might be fairly significant from the standpoint that we see other components, other pesticides and its degradants often commonly present with atrazine. And studies by Dr. Hayes as well as others has indicated that at fairly low concentrations and important with the presence of other components that could be very harmful to amphibians and other aquatic species. And so one thing that's also come up is that we've seen it is present, atrazine, in some water supplies. We've seen it down in Hastings in the wells, although the concentrations are fairly low, less than 0.3 parts per billion. It is present in aquifers that are areas where it tends to occur or are fairly sensitive areas are sand plain aquifers that can be found throughout the state, as well as karst regions. Those are areas where, particularly, where there is some concern as far as finding pesticides, and often it's associated with nitrates found in the areas. And so that's my point.
Thank you for your testimony.
Finally, we have Dr. Vincent Gehry from the University, formerly
Welcome.
From the University of Minnesota.
Oh, I'm still
Welcome to the committee, Dr. Gehry.
Yeah, I'm Vinny Gehry. I'm a professor emeritus in the Department of Laboratory and Medicine and Pathology at the University of Minnesota. I'm board-certified toxicologist, and I'm a member of the Board of Directors of the American Board of Toxicology. And I'm a retired colonel in the Army. Chemical defense is my specialty. And so I know a little bit about poison. Okay. And what we live in a milieu where we're living with our own hormones, and they're there in very, very low concentrations. But they have big effects. And they have big effects because they hit little things we call receptors, and they magnify effects. We can either be too fat, too thin, too tall, or too short because of our hormones. Imagine, if you will, you've got other substances which can also hit those receptors, and they're exogenous chemicals. And so you can shift your hormone level simply by doing that. And the end result of that can be anything from a birth defect, or it can be just shifting hormone levels in terms of thyroid hormone. Now, I'd like to divert a little here. For the last 15 years, we've been studying and publishing about the world of pesticides in people and birth defects and cancer and all that sort of thing. And I have a bit of a handout for you. And I promise it won't be too bad.
It's in your packet there.
But anyway, in the handout, what we did in our state It's divided our state into about four different areas. And we used the region I call the forest urban region as our control region. And we did cancer mortality studies. We did cardiovascular mortality studies. We did birth defect studies in each of these regions. Okay. Now, first we did what we would call a low-power scanning lens, which is basically a mortality study. And if you look at your second insert here, I got about three or four different studies that we did in different parts of the state, and also the state mortality overall. I just want to turn your attention to one area of interest, is that, for example, in the Red River Valley, thyroid cancer mortality is about, among the men, it's almost three times the expected, and that's statistically significant. Mortality in the women isn't quite so bad. Then we did a highly focused study up in the Red River Valley looking at a laboratory-based study in which we actually looked at hormone levels in the applicators of pesticides. We also looked at birth defects and things of that nature. And what we found basically is that in terms of the pesticide applicators who are farmers, that you're supposed to have about maybe 1 in 100 having a clinically significant abnormal thyroid function. We found 5. We found that in when they're applying pesticides, there are significant shifts in thyroid hormone levels that we could demonstrate. And then we also did studies that relate to testosterone. And in those studies, we first looked at, again, using the low-power scanning lens approach, we looked at first the generalized birth defect rates in the state by general population, by private applier. And as you can see up in the valley, up in the valley, that tends to be higher than most. So the birth defects rate up in the valley is pretty high. Then you look at season of conception when the kids are born, when the kids are conceived, and most of the birth defects occur when the kids are conceived in the spring. Okay. Spring is the time when we apply herbicides like atrazine. And then on the next table there, remember there was a little talk about your general birth defects and that sort of thing? By God, it really happens. We saw an excess, a significant excess of your general birth defects in and among the applicators in particular. And these are farmers in the Red River Valley. And then the next thing that we did was look at the sex of the kids that are born. And what you need to know is that males, there are more males than females that are usually born, but the other part of it is that there are all more males that have birth defects than females, usually. Okay. Now, so when we look at sex ratio then, the ratio of male to female, and we see it's significantly altered, okay, then we can suspect and something damn well is wrong, okay? So we see alterations in the fellows who are applying fungicides. And then the next thing that we did was in our laboratory studies, we also measured testosterone levels in the applicators. And lo and behold, the applicators who had the lowest testosterone levels had to have more kids that were female rather than male. And not only that, they were the guys who applied the most fungicides, herbicides, the whole nine yards as compared to everybody else. So in general, we already know, or we now know, that we're having real-time effects in real people, not in just frogs, of hormone disruptors. Okay. Now, one more thing, and this is the one that gets me in trouble all the time. But part of our studies, one of the things that we did was to try to look at what the commercial grade herbicides were like, what was in them, really. You know. And one of the things that we had is a little receptor assay, you know, to see whether it would tweak a receptor. And this particular assay system was basically to tweak and to look at dioxin receptor. Okay. And we saw that there are a bunch of commercial-grade herbicides, 2,4-D derivatives, which actually did tweak that receptor. The pure material never did. Okay. So with a twisting of a few arms of friends of mine, I convinced the screening technology is dirt cheap. The analytic chemistry is really expensive, guys. So I convinced some people at USDA to test out some of our commercial-grade herbicides, and lo and behold, they did find dioxin contamination in some of these herbicides in pretty significant levels. And in closing, you can't prove it, but dioxins are known to produce increased cardiovascular disease mortality. They're known to alter sex ratio, and they're known to produce birth defects. Could be. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, that's Senator the end Marty. Of my witnesses. I want to remind the committee that, again, we've had, there have been some 40-some peer-reviewed, published scientific studies on the concerns of this. Again, they've showed impacts on hormone disruption at least as low as 1/10 of a part per billion. This would suggest, in effect, this legislation that the department set a standard of 1 part per billion. They could do it more than that, but they would have to provide justification that it still meets the standards in the law of Section 144 to make sure we're protecting particularly vulnerable populations. I'm happy to stand for questions. I know there are some people from the Department of Agriculture here and somebody from Syngenta as well.
We have Senator Berglund, Senator Higgins, and Senator Hand. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I just wanted to point out that the addition of paragraph B in the amendment will cause the bill to have a fiscal note.
Right. Madam Chair, I'm...
Senator Marty, you're aware of
it. I'm aware, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, I'm just trying to understand the two paragraphs. Do I understand it correctly that the first paragraph sets an immediate standard of 3 parts per billion, but by December the department has to study and come up with a different number? Am I understanding
Chair,
this correctly?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, yes. The right now, again, the 3 parts per billion is federal law for public drinking water. In effect, we'd be bringing down the private well standard to that 3 parts per billion now. Our current standard is 20 parts per billion. We'd be setting it across the board in Minnesota, would be at the federal level of 3 parts per billion now. And then the department would review it this year. They would review the levels to find out what's appropriate. And again, because of federal law, they couldn't be going above the 3 parts per billion, but they would set it what they feel appropriate. If it's over 1 part per billion, again, 10 times that threshold where it's we know it has some impacts. If they said it above that, they'd have to provide a written justification, in effect, why they came up with the number.
Senator Hagan.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Marty, if you don't want the level to be set higher than 1 part per billion, why don't we just set it at 1 part per billion?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, that would be more direct way of doing this, but if they find out, if they study the evidence and so on, and they don't think 1 part per billion is justified, then we're not pinning them down. In other words, that would be a stricter proposal than this. I'm trying to say, have them take a look at it and figure out what makes sense. Based on what we've seen, seems to me 1 part per billion is reasonable, but if they don't agree, they don't have to. They just have to make it clear that they believe it is meeting the standards in the current law that it has to protect the population, including vulnerable segments of the population. So in other words, I'd like to see it 1 part per billion. Rather than specify it in law, I think it'd be better to have them take a more careful look at it and then make their determination.
Okay.
Thank you. Senator Hahn?
Thank you.
Senator Dahl?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Marty, or maybe the witnesses, I guess one thing I just want to confirm that in the testimony that we've heard, there has not been any testimony to suggest there's any causal relationship between atrazine and any of the things that have been talked about, that there's been some correlations that have been done. In fact, the testimony, I think, of Professor Geary would suggest that there's correlations that can be shown. But in my mind, and maybe I'm wrong, there's a difference between correlation and causation. And if we're talking about saying that one thing causes another, that's a higher standard of evidence that needs to be brought into play. And I just want to make sure that what I've heard so far, what we've heard so far, is there has been no testimony as to causation. The second thing, and Senator Marty, maybe you can address the bill itself. When in paragraph A of the bill where you say that the PCA shall set water standards and so forth, what happens when they discover that the water standards don't comply with that level? Does that mean that people no longer can use the water? Or what is the remedy that is going to occur if such a level is discovered?
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, I'll have Ms. Helgen speak to at least the second one. The consequences of not compliance, I'm not sure if somebody from Health Department is here. I know water doesn't always comply with it. I'm not sure, like, for... if it's for public water system, they have to filter, they have to address it. For private wells, I'm not sure what the standard is in the health department. I'm not sure if they are here, but I would guess they are and could speak to what the impact is on it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Dr. Hayes's work was laboratory research where he exposed a whole lot of different species of frogs to atrazine at different concentrations. So I would say that would be cause and effect because he would have controls in those situations. And then he has, in more recent years, demonstrated this out in the natural environment, too, by looking at water concentrations in ponds and then looking at the gonads of the frogs.
And Madam?
Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair, and thank you. Maybe I should make my comment more clarified or the things that were being talked about that were relating to human health effects that were being noted in the documentation, those were things that were correlations that were noted rather than that they were causally related to a particular, an atrazine in particular. I know the testimony was about herbicides, fungicides, fungicides in general, but that the testimony wasn't to say that atrazine caused those conditions in the human beings in the study that Professor Geary presented.
Senator Hahn, I'll just say one quick thing that I'm not a health person, what Dr. Hayes points out is that the hormones are the same. So if you have a mechanism in place because you have a chemical that actually will convert testosterone to estrogen, and estrogen is known to cause cancers and act as an endocrine disruptor in humans. So I think Dr. Geary would speak more to that.
Dr.
Madam
Geary.
Chair, Senator, you're looking at one of the limitations of epidemiology. Most of the things that we can do at the human level are limited in terms of actually determining cause and effect. You develop an association, but hardly ever can you develop cause. There are ways that we can develop cause, and using my military side of me, we can. You know, for example, you can expose individuals who are volunteers to various and sundry poisons and see what happens to them. You could do that. But we don't do that anymore, hopefully. But in the meantime, what we need to do is to develop associations. And so we use the tools that we have. And the tools that we have are basically counting numbers, doing laboratory studies that are out in the field, doing hormone measurements, getting as close as we can, measuring the levels in the blood, in the urine, of the pesticides. That's about as close as you get. And what we're dealing with in the environment right now is a mixed exposure to all kinds of things. and it's very, very difficult.
And
Senator Hayne.
And Madam Chair, and thank you, Professor Gary. And I think that's kind of my point, is that we have lots of things in the environment, and yet this bill is directed at one thing. And so the argument is that this one thing is the problem that we need to focus on when, as you're saying, there are a great multitude of things, and they act in a relationship, and there could be all kinds of things that we don't even know about that are having an effect on the kind of things you're observing. And so my question is simply, how are we confident that this remedy is going to address the problem that you've outlined? And what if we take this remedy and nothing changes? Does that mean we should go back on the remedy and repeal the restriction? And,
Madam Chair, Senator.
Dr. Gary.
It's a first step. That's about where it stands. It's a first step of allowing us to begin to control at least one of the endocrine disruptors in our environment. Okay. This one, in particular, is bothersome because it is persistent. Okay, this one hangs around, and it's around all over the place. Okay, and that's the worry, more so than some of the other things I've spoken about. Most of the things that, for example, occur in the valley are there and gone. You know, they're not going to hang around for months at a time. This stuff is. You know. And in the right setting, it'll actually hang around for years. So you imagine constant exposure to this crap. That ain't going to be good.
Senator Marty, I would like to make sure that members know we have to move because the Education Committee meeting will start in a few minutes. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, is there a way to get it out of the water? I mean, if we find that wells have more than one part per billion, and we decide one part per billion is a safe standard, is there a way to get it out of the water so people can actually use their wells?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I believe granular activated charcoal filters do that. I have one in our home kitchen sink one, and the box on that says that, yes, it does cut atrazine levels in the water by, 90-some percent, 99% or so. That's just a basic, cheap home filter. There are ways of getting it out of the system, yes, and that's what we'd be doing if we're setting the limit. We'd be making sure that, first of all, I think a lot of farmers, Mr. Sobosinski said, once used it and are backing away from it out of concerns. And again, one final follow-up on Senator Hand's point. Again, the European Union has banned this because of that concern, and it's still, you can still find it in groundwater there, even though it's been banned for several years. So it's something that doesn't get rid of right away, but you can filter it out of the water.
There are some people who wish to testify against this. I know Senator Dahl had a question. Senator Erickson Rose, Senator Wergen had questions. And there was an issue, I think, that was mentioned in the presentation here and also from Dr. Hayes. The way they deal with it in Europe is they simply banned atrazine from the market. So they were very clear about how you do this is by banning
this bill
it from
doesn't
the
do that.
Right.
So I just wanted to make sure if somebody had a well that had more in it that, you know, would they be able to sell their land? Would they be able to use the water? And that was my question.
Thank you. We're going to do these questions quickly, and then we need to move on because we have a lot of other people who wish to testify. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess just to follow up what Senator Hand was saying, though, is on the opposite side of it. Is there some chemicals other than atrazine that are highly suspected of causing some of these problems?
Seriously. A lot of them.
All right. Well,
depends
we
on the list
all
you look at, but I mean, here. Let's try to try for this picture. We have these little proteins in us, okay, and they are easily tweaked by all kinds of little things, okay, and some of them are really, really, really quite have a high affinity for these receptors, and they are the ones that you get concerned about. And they can vary from something like an atrazine to, I'll give you another name, zearalenone. How's that one, eh? Zearalenone is actually a fungal toxin, okay, which is a pseudoestrogen as well. Okay, so some natural chemicals, natural toxins, fungal toxins can also be pseudoestrogens, can also have endocrine effects. Then you have your little friendly dioxin, which is a pretty good endocrine disruptor. You know, 10 to the minus 8 molar, really low. So you look for those kinds, and atrazine fits in that category. Okay? That's why I get a little uptight, because it fits in that category, and it's there all the time. And that sucker's got to go.
Thank you. Senator Erickson Robes.
Thank you. Just one comment. I have one very small community in southeastern Minnesota that I represent. It's at the crossroads of two country roads. And the name of the town is Newburgh. And that little town has Velcroed itself to my heart because every household in Newburgh, except one family who's just recently moved there, every household has cancer. And they're at a country crossroads surrounded by ag land.
Yes.
So I think this is a great first step, as you're talking about. You know, we have concerns that these toxins are getting into the water. I think we need to work with our ag community because we do live, southeastern Minnesota is a very karst region. Our farmers are very concerned about water quality. I think we all need to work together, and this seems to me to be a very good first step. And I like the one part per billion as well, but it's up to you, Senator Marty, to go with the two paragraphs here. But I just want to put that out there because in real terms, you know, we can talk about molecules and particles and scientific studies, but this is about people's lives. And I want to know why everyone in Newburgh is suffering.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I don't know when the appropriate time is, but I do have an amendment to the bill.
Okay. Fine. Go ahead, Senator Wergen.
Madam Chair, I have the A4 amendment.
It's being passed around.
Madam Chair, one of the testifiers referred to atrazine as crap, and I think the great number of farmers in my district would not call atrazine crap as it relates to farming. It is a very useful and many would say essential tool in farming. And the other thing about this particular chemical, atrazine, is that the Department of Agriculture has extensive knowledge about atrazine, how to test atrazine, what they're looking for, concentrations of atrazine, what it's composed of. So the Department of Ag is very well equipped to look over or watch over the content of atrazine in anything, even in drinking water. And so what this amendment does is takes the Pollution Control Agency out of setting the limit and works with the Department of Agriculture, who has the most extensive knowledge of this particular chemical. And so I'm not taking the bill down or anything. I believe what I'm doing is putting the standards in the appropriate department, which is the department that knows what atrazine is, has seen the testing results, and is by far the most familiar with it.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Wergen, the PCA is actually the agency that deals with water quality standards. I think the Department of Agriculture would be and is likely to be involved in this. I find the amendment acceptable if you removed on lines 3 and 5 the word delete and put after. So in effect, you'd be saying, well, in consultation with the PCA and Department of Agriculture, so you'll get them involved, because PCA is actually the agency that is the one that makes the determinations. I mean, they're the ones who deal with the water quality issue, but I think the Department of Agriculture certainly has interest in the issue and involving them in it, too. I'd be happy to support adding them to it, in other words, but I think the PCA should be involved because it's they're the ones who do that.
Madam Chair, my main concern is getting the Department of Ag involved, so I will accept that as a change, a friendly change to the amendment.
And then, so if it says after PCA, insert Department of Agriculture, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to support the amendment.
Okay. Any questions about the amendment, Senator Erickson-Ropes?
I want to speak in favor of Senator Wergen's amendment. I just said, you know, that we have a lot of farmers, and farmers are concerned about water quality. And I'm also very much a stakeholder, a consensus builder, and I think that Department of Ag does need to be at the table. I thank Senator Wergen for catching that and bringing that up. You know, when I'm back home talking to my rural folks, you know, if it has to do with farming, farmers need to be part of the solution. So I very much support the addition.
Any other questions? If not, all of those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
As amended.
Aye.
No, we're not moving the bill yet.
No, the amendment as
the
amended.
The amendment as amended, yes. Those opposed, the amendment is adopted. Senator Marty. Anybody else that wish to testify?
Madam Chair, I believe there are some people from Department of Agriculture and a person from Syngenta who wish to speak to the bill as well.
I would like to ask them to please move forward and please be as brief as possible. We need to move from this room, and we have, I think, one or two other bills that we need to hear. So if you could be brief, we will really appreciate it. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Greg Bazicki. I'm the Division Director of the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division at the Department of Agriculture. And I will be exceptionally brief, although I know some of the members of the committees know that I could talk about this for a long time. The department and the administration oppose this bill, although with due respect, we do appreciate the addition in the amendment that Senator Wergen added. There is a very robust pesticide regulatory system at the federal and the state level dealing with setting standards and regulation, and it's for that reason that we oppose the bill. We believe the system is working and should be allowed to work as it is with our partners, the Department of Health and the Pollution Control Agency. And finally, I know some of the members are aware of this, but this is an audit that was completed of the pesticide regulatory system just last March. And in it, the Office of the Legislative Auditor said the Department of Agriculture does a good job regulating and monitoring pesticides. So I'd refer the members to this report. And with that, Madam Chair, I completed my statement.
Thank you. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Mr. Bazicki, if the Department of Ag's regulation is so robust and you do such a good job, why is your standard now at 20 parts per billion and the federal standard is at 3?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, the Department of Agriculture does not actually is not the agency that sets the standards. That's the Department of Health.
And have you had conversations with the Department of Health, telling them that they need to get it down to something less than 20, as the robust regulation that you said you do would set in place?
Madam Chair, I believe last Wednesday we had a briefing by the Department of Health of their rulemaking process, and they're proceeding with that. So I know that is actually culminating in a change that should be out relatively soon. I don't know exactly the date. The Department of Health could speak to that, but I know they have been looking at that and evaluating all the information that has been generated in the re-registration process. At the federal level, it was a 12-year process that was just recently culminated.
Thank you. Senator Prednisone.
Madam Chair, Mr. Fizicki, if you're already going to do this, then the law, then this bill shouldn't bother you.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator, the legislative directive on setting standards would separate out dealing with the scientific process that is taking place at the federal and state level. That's our concern.
What? I don't understand.
There is a process that addresses the issues of setting standards, and that should be allowed to continue unfettered.
Senator Mr. Fizicki, Is it accurate that the federal level is 3 parts per billion and Minnesota now is at 20 parts per billion?
Madam,
and that we need to get down to that level, and that's what this bill states?
Yes. Madam Chair, there's the MCL at the federal level, and again, I'm familiar with this, but I'm not the expert. The maximum contaminant level applied to public drinking water supplies is at 3 at the federal level, and the health risk level in Minnesota, which is something different than the maximum contaminant level, is at 20. But it is my understanding that the Department of Health and the EPA are evaluating more recent information and in the process of making changes. And that will continue. That standard may move up or it may move down.
Are any other, could you,
Madam
Senator
Chair?
Brandon Sullivan.
Will that be accomplished by December 31st of 2007?
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't know.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam
Introduce
Chair.
Introduce yourself.
And Senators, thank you for having me here. My name is Timothy Pasteur. I have a PhD in toxicology from the University of Michigan. I'm board certified in toxicology. I'm a member of the Society of Toxicology and the Society for Risk Analysis. And my job at Syngenta Crop Protection is, in fact, human safety. And I take that very seriously. And talking to my wife about this before coming here, and I said, you know, what should I say here? And she said, well, you've got to first say that these things matter and that integrity is very, very high priority for me personally and certainly for us in Syngenta. I won't take long here because I know you've got a process here that you need to get to, and I'm noticing that you have a very rigorous process, Robert's Rules, and a number of other things that makes the decision-making process work here. Now, that process is extremely important here. It's also very important in the regulation of pesticides. That process has been in place for quite some time, and certainly for atrazine, it has been in place for 12 years in a special review. I can tell you without hesitation that atrazine is easily one of the best studied molecules on the face of the planet. Over 6,000 studies were submitted to EPA for their review in re-registering atrazine last year. It took 12 years to review that information to make sure that that decision was right. In order to make that happen, there was a process that EPA used called a scientific advisory panel, where they bring in academic experts from all over the world to take a look at this information and make judgments about what it means. These are not Syngenta people. They're not even EPA people. They're academics that do not have a vested interest in atrazine. 3 scientific advisory panels looking at the cancer and looking at frog amphibian effects and epidemiology of atrazine have all concluded that atrazine can be re-registered, and it was, as a matter of fact, last year. So the process is extremely important, and I think that that's what your question was, Senator, about how do you go about setting these kinds of numbers, 3, 6, 10, 12, 40, whatever the numbers are, there's a process for doing that. And I believe that's articulated very clearly in Section 144.0751, which is in the second paragraph of this particular bill. And what that does is it says you have to use scientifically robust information to make decisions. And those decisions have been made at the EPA level. They're the final arbiter on this, and we have to live by that. We agree with the process, even though we don't necessarily agree with the exact number. Now, that process, let me just tell you very quickly, is done by looking at all of the information and making sure that you know where you get effects in animals and where you don't, where you think they might occur in humans and where you don't, and then putting safety factors along with that. So the numbers that you're seeing in front of you, whether they're 4 or whether they're 3 or whether they're 20, are at the bottom of a whole lot of uncertainty safety factors that are built in there just to make sure that you're protecting not only humans because you do the studies in animals, but you're also looking at sensitive populations, as I heard before, about fetuses and children. And as a father, I can tell you this is something I take very seriously. So these uncertainty factors, safety factors is what they're called, are built in there to make sure that everything is going to be properly used and that safety is assured. The way I I teach this to students is to try and say, look, this is how an uncertainty factor or a safety factor is actually applied. If you were to stand next to a fire and determine that you could stand 5 feet away from that fire and be safe, you would then say, all right, I want to make sure that I can be perfectly safe here. I'm going to put a tenfold safety factor. I'm going to stand 50 feet away from that. Well, then EPA takes another tenfold factor and says, we're going to allow you to stand 500 feet away from that fire. And we can assure you that you're going to be safe. Now, that's not where EPA stops. In the case of atrazine, they added an additional tenfold safety factor for the safety of children, infants, and others. So you would be standing 5,000 feet away from that fire. That's about a mile away from a fire, which you've determined you can stand 5 feet away from and still have no effects. That's basically how the process is done at EPA. So when we're talking about levels of 3 or 4 or 20 or 100, it's after the application of all of these safety factors. Just want to make sure you understood that. That and the fact that there was over 6,000 studies, full EPA review over 12 years, 3 SAPs to try and come to this decision to re-register atrazine last year. And I'll end with this note, Madam Chair, just trying to make sure that it goes into the record that not only do we take this responsibility very seriously about a product that Syngenta manufactures as one of five manufacturers of atrazine, but in fact, this is an incredibly important product to the economy of the state of Minnesota and certainly to farmers in the state of Minnesota. This is a product that has been shown to increase crop yields. It's an inexpensive product for farmers to use, and we all know what the margins are for farmers, certainly in the state of Minnesota and across the nation, indeed. It also has a big effect on the current issues about trying to develop an economic base for biofuels as well, in which the state of Minnesota plays a significant role. So amongst all those reasons, it has significant opportunities for farmers. I heard the statement earlier that farmers use this as a tool. It's inexpensive and it works. That's magic for a farmer when they hear those kinds of words, and they've been using it for over 47 years very effectively and safely. And the other aspect of it, too, is that it would have an impact on the economy of the state of Minnesota. And so I'd like to end on that and just say that, yes, we take this very seriously. There is a process. That process was enacted over a long period of time, tremendous number of studies on atrazine. We know more about this molecule than just about anything else. There are adequate safety margins that have been set. The process is important. We might not agree with the exact number, but the process was in place. And to take this product away from Minnesota farmers, I think, would be a big mistake. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony. And again, I'm going to ask you to please be brief. We really have to leave this room in about 4 minutes. So, and we have another bill that we need to hear. You. So,
well, please, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
If I might interrupt for just a minute, the folks in favor of this bill had approximately 40 minutes to testify. I think there's a little bit inequity when we tell the people that do not favor a bill that they've had approximately 5 minutes at this point, and they must hurry.
Well, they excuse me, Senator Worthing, they have had about 20 minutes, but we could table it and continue the discussion if we need to, but it's just that we need to leave the room. So I need to respect that process for the next committee. Please,
Madam Chair, I'll be very brief. My name is Valerie Jarek, and I'm a lobbyist for the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. They oppose the bill that sets any standard less than the federal standard. So we are willing to see that standard set at the federal level, but not less than that. Right now, it's an effective crop protection tool for Minnesota farmers, and we believe that to set that standard lower than the federal level would penalize Minnesota farmers. It would increase their costs of production. Their inputs would then be higher than neighboring states, and we would no longer be competitive with our neighboring states when we're providing our crops. Atrazine's had thorough federal review. You've heard about that from Syngenta. The farmers follow strict guidelines on the application of this and handling of the product. They tell me that they are using about half of what other Corn Belt states use in the state of Minnesota. You did hear a lot about the studies from the Red River Valley. There's not a lot of corn grown in the Red River Valley area, so most of the application for atrazine is used for corn, and it is in the other sections of the state of Minnesota other than the Red River Valley. So there's another phenomenon going on within those studies, apparently. I won't go on and on about it, but we just wanted you to know that the corn growers oppose any standard that would be less than the federal standard.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Bond. I represent the Minnesota Crop Production Input Retailers. Our members are the folks that supply, manufacture, distribute crop inputs to the farmers of Minnesota, and we would think that an action that is proposed in this amendment would be very unfortunate and a very, very bad precedent for Minnesota, leaving science behind and moving into a decision that is something less than science. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from members of the committee? Are there any other individuals in the audience who wish to testify about this bill? Senator Worgen.
Madam Chair, as we consider what has to happen with this bill, I believe that this bill needs to be heard by the Agriculture Committee as well. This is a product that's essential to agriculture in Minnesota. And Senator Vickerman has been very conscientious in making sure that the environment is protected, people are protected, and crop production continues, because agriculture is still one of our number one economic factors in this state. And with that in mind, I would hope that Senator Marty would move this bill to go to the Agriculture Committee.
Thank
Madam
you.
Chair.
Senator Marty.
Yes, I'll make that motion. I do want to remind members again that the European Union, which has seen these studies as well, has not limited its level in water. It's banned the product. Syngenta cannot use it in its own country, the country it's located in. But I would move that Senate File 2056 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Agriculture. I believe that would be the appropriate next step.
Thank you. Any questions?
Madam
Any
Chair.
Comments? Senator Hand.
Well, and just I'm glad that Senator Marty made that point. I was going to ask Dr. Pastour about that comment, and can you comment on that? I just would like to know more about the reason for the ban in Europe.
Let me set the record straight on two very important items. Number one, it is sold and it is registered in Switzerland, which is the headquarters for Syngenta. So setting the record straight on that, respectfully. Secondly, it is not banned in the European Union. There is a analytical standard there in the European Union that says that anything that exceeds that level cannot be on the registered list to be used by farmers. It's not banned. And that is the correct way of putting it. It is not a health-based standard. It's an analytical one. Furthermore, there's one other product that is almost exactly the same thing as atrazine that's used in the European Union. It's called terbutalazine. It's almost exactly the same thing as atrazine. It's registered throughout the European Union.
Thank you. Any more questions or comments from the committee? If not, Senator Marty, could you please?
I move the bill be recommended pass referred to the Committee on Agriculture.
All of those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion aye. Carries. Thank you, Senator
Thank you,
Marty.
Madam Chair.
And do we have time to
announce the 6 o'clock meeting tonight?
Yeah, we come back tonight.
Okay. We are now being in recess, and we'll come back at 6 p.m. to this room. Thank you.
And Tony gets to be first.
Possible. I'll just talk about